C2 PR Number 8A.
We go on to the next subtone, which will be life. But when we read the text, we will be surprised. The text reads on line 23, God is love, full stop. So again, one could think, well, Mrs. Eddy gets out of rhythm here. Instead of saying something about the desire, she says just something about God and nothing about mind, nothing about life. But God is love. Can we ask him to be more? Now again, the moment you have asking, you naturally get the prayer attitude. And we will see what kind of prayer attitude is necessary. Can we ask him to be more? Again, love is the top, is the climax, is the fulfillment. There is nothing more to be added to love. So again, she interjects here the scriptural note 2. Says, don't forget, God is love. Don't forget that. Now, if you want to ask God something, don't forget his love. He cannot be more than what he is. So, can we ask him to be more? God is intelligence. We say, mind. And can we inform the infinite mind of anything he does not already comprehend? Terrific sense of mind and love. That mind comprehends, but it comprehends what? Love, namely all. There is nothing more to be comprehended. Gives a terrific sense of that Father that knows our need. Of that sense that God is love, and love can be not more than what love is the climax of it, and that is mind, and that love comprehends already all. He knows all, love knows all, and therefore nothing is unknown to that mind. Now, do we expect to change perfection? Can you see, again comes in that change, which is soul. But she started out with that change in mind as soul, an unchangeable deity that we have to change. Then, in principle, this science cannot be changed. And now, here, perfection cannot be changed. Can you hear, gives a terrific sense of that changelessness of soul, but now taking it over to love always, that cannot change perfection. So again, it's still in the tone of the second scriptural note of love and mind, and that love and mind is the climax of giving, and that cannot be changed. So can you see, she goes back, so to say, and takes up the subject where it was before, so that you have always to remember, you see, that when she writes, see, she doesn't write bang, bang, bang. She writes this way. It flows into each other. She takes up the subject where she left it or where she left it before and still before that and picks it up again and says, well, I must show you the flow of these things and how these ideas flow into each other. So here, up to this point, we have seen nothing about life in this paragraph. And yet she introduces, naturally, life. But in order to introduce the abundance of life, the fullness of life, the open fount of life, the source of all existence, all life, in order to introduce that, she just first reminds us, you know, love and mind is unchangeable. Perfection is unchangeable. You can't do more than all. So shall, and we get the tone. Shall we plead? See, that's the desire now. Shall we plead? How is our desire? The pleading. Shall we plead for more at the open fount? The moment you have the open fount, you know that's life, the well of life, the source of life, the abundance of life, the fullness of life. Shall we plead for more at the open fount, which is pouring forth more than we accept? Can you hear the tone of the flow of life, the abundance of life, the fullness of life? Or it goes even further, the unspoken desire. Again, you have now the attitude of prayer, the desire, even the unspoken desire, does bring us nearer to the source. Can you hear how she says that leads us to the source of life, to the well of life? Does bring us nearer to the source of all existence. Do you hear life? And blessedness, love. Do you see that she starts out the paragraph not with the tone of life, but by preparing the tone of life in order to prepare life as the source of life, as the well of life, as the source of all existence? She wants to say that source of existence is a terrific big source of existence, because behind it is love and mind. That's why she starts out love and mind. Love, God is love, he cannot be more. God is mind, he is the all intelligence that already comprehends all. Now all that is now shown from the point of view. Therefore, let's desire to get nearer to this beautiful source of all life. The desire brings us, a true desire brings us nearer now to that source of life, of all existence and blessedness. Do we plead for more at the open fount, which is pouring forth more than we accept? Can you hear the superabundance of life that says, I give you always a million times more than what you need. I give you more than what you can take. You know, it isn't a little river that twiddles out and then sinks into the ground and it's no more. It is a terrific stream that says, I always give in abundance, more than what you need. And this is really what I like to call the redundancy principle. Because the redundancy principle are the synonymous term. If we are thinking in synonymous terms instead of ideas, then we are always thinking in the redundancy. Is that a term you know, redundancy? It's more than what you need. Huh? It's 10 times more, 100 times more than what is necessary. So any treatment we give on that redundancy principle, which is a treatment from the point of view of the capitalized terms, is always a redundant, because it may only necessary to see one idea that really is in need, a specific idea, like intelligence, say, or like leading. Instead of working with an idea of leading and guiding, say, all right, I need some guidance, I must be led rightly, so I work with these ideas, that's a 6,000-year period, not the 7,000-year period. We are at the verge from the 6th to the 7th, because instead of working, say, for guidance and being led and being steered to the right occasion and so on, why not treat it from mind? Because mind includes guidance, steering, you see, leading. But it also includes perhaps even more than what there is necessary. Namely, it may include also the intelligence for guiding. May also include the power of guiding. Can you see? So the moment we can treat, handle a situation from the synonymous terms or capitalized terms, these are not only the seven, there are also the four, from the capitalized terms, we use the redundancy principle. Because mind is 10 times bigger than guiding. You see that, huh? So, naturally, the danger is that we could be tempted to say, all right, now that's wonderful, let's have the easy way. Let's only treat from the capitalized terms. But that naturally means that we have a full tonality of the capitalized terms within ourselves. Or it doesn't work. Or it is then the synonymous terms are only terms. Is that clear? So that you don't go home and say, oh, that's fine, I'm no more, I don't need to study anymore the ideas characterizing the seven synonymous terms, I don't need to do that anymore. Max, that take the whole, take the seven synonymous terms, and so I just take the seven synonymous terms. That wouldn't work because those terms would only be terms. And terms don't work. Terms have no Christ power. It's the consciousness of the terms, the tonality of those seven synonymous terms that have a Christ, the Christ power to do something. So we are still going the ordered way of first saying, well, there are synonymous terms, we don't know really what they mean, therefore we study the seven synonymous term in the textbook in order to find out through what ideas each synonymous term is characterized, and then I have still only concept building. From that point on, I must go to tonality building, and I must get the tone of the seven. But when we get the tone of the seven, we can drop the individual ideas, because then the tone of the seven gives you an atmosphere of all the ideas together. Not the thinking about the ideas, but an atmosphere of all the ideas constituting a synonymous term. And that is entering the 7,000-year period. Is that clear? It may not be clear to everyone, because this we have been considering last year in the summer school quite a bit. But as a whole, is it? Oh, I'm a silly old ass. I always ask, and I know perfectly well that you don't say no. Yeah. So, how did we epitomize it here? It thereby, actually it goes back to the principle, such a prayer brings us into harmony with the science of being. So it's already a tone of life in it, of being. It's the principle of being. It's not the principle of healing or the principle of marriage or the principle of this or that or the other. It's the principle of being. And now comes life, and it thereby brings us nearer to the open source of all existence. So this kind of prayer brings us right to the source of all existence. Let's go on to the next one. And I read, asking God, again, asking is a desire standpoint, a prayer standpoint, asking God to be God. She italicized be to bring out the accent there. is a vain repetition. This sentence still has the tone of life. It's the beingness of God. And says, don't ask God to be. He is. You know, it's a funny thing. The human mind is really funny. We never ask a dog to be a dog. And we never say to a dog, behave like a dog. He does it anyway. He is a dog, and he behaves like a dog. You never have to ask him to be what he is. But we do that with God. We ask God to be what he really is, and not to forget it, because we feel he forgot it. He forgot to act as a God. Huh? We have to make him act as a God. We constantly hammer it into that dear God Almighty and say, now, come on, come on, be what you are, act as what you are. We wouldn't do that with a dog. I not with God. It's a whole funny religious attitude within us still that doesn't accept that. So she goes on and says, God is the same yesterday and today and forever. Again, the tone of life. So she builds a bridge from the preceding paragraph to this paragraph and takes it up and says, yes, God is what he is. He behaves as God has to behave. He operates as God has to operate. And that brings us to truth. Therefore, she says, and he who is immutably, right? Can you see again, immutably, changeless? That tone goes right through to say right from the beginning, God is what he is. That doesn't move, that doesn't change. And now here, at the point of truth, it says, he is immutably right. Now comes in truth. The tone of right, that he is right, is immutably right. And will do right without being reminded of his province. Here she says what we say of a dog. We don't ask a dog to behave like a dog. He behaves himself anyway like a dog, never as a human being. Thank God. So he operates the way he operates. And now she says, this is really the nature of being. God will do right. We don't have to ask him to behave rightly. The wisdom of man is not sufficient to, warrant him in advising God. So you get here the whole tone of truth, that truth does right without being reminded of doing right. Can you see now the epitome? It acknowledges, it is that prayer, it acknowledges that God does right without giving him advice. Do you see the tone of truth in it? The truth is doing right. Formulating epitomes, I would say that always try to use as much as you can the terminology of the text. You see it in here that there are practically always terms or words that appear in the text itself. It helps us not to deviate too much. Actually, it doesn't mean to copy the terms, because an epitome is anyway an abbreviation of a long text, but the main piece we can always take from the text. Like, God does right without giving him advice. We come to the last one. The last one says, that important one, it has the side note, the spiritual mathematics. Who would... I just saw something. Sorry, I want to go quickly back. Just for the sake of text interpretation. You see, we had on the page 2, we had further down as a marginal heading. I speak now quickly about marginal headings, because that has always been a great discussion point in the movement, in Christian Science. Did Mrs. Eddy write the marginal headings, or did Wiggins write them? And apparently there is not a uniform policy in the publishing house. If it really should take the marginal headings as standard teaching of Mrs. Eddy or not, that I don't know. I just can't figure out that Mrs. Eddy left something in the textbook which she didn't want to have it in. But somebody has sent me a few years ago a letter from the editors of the journal. That student had written an article around a marginal heading. And so they refused it and made the remark, I can't exactly quote it, it just comes into my mind, but the meaning of it was that it is questionable that Mrs. Eddy wrote it, and therefore one should not write an article round about a marginal heading. Isn't that so, Jean? Yeah. Did I say more or less rightly? Yeah. Well, I can't accept that really, because Mrs. Eddy used to change every little term when she wanted to change them, and certainly didn't leave in anything she didn't want to. It may have been that originally somebody had suggested those marginal headings. I guess it was Wiggins. But she would correct that and correct that. For us, we have quite a different difficulty. We have a difficulty with the marginal headings. And perhaps this is the place where I can talk about it fundamentally. See, we had up on the first paragraph, the marginal heading, right motives. That was in the tone of mind as spirit. And right motives can give you really that tone of mind as spirit, especially if you would have said pure motives, but pure is also right. And she was talking there all about the right motive, that the motive must go out for the righteousness, must go out after righteousness, that motive must be pure. So it more or less hinted the tone of mind and spirit. Then we had in the next paragraph, mind as soul, the marginal heading, deity unchangeable, and that was bang on. That was soul. So the marginal heading just was bang on. It had the same tonality as soul. There is no marginal heading in principle, tone, which she doesn't need to do. That's her liberty to make marginal headings whenever she likes to do it and when she feels it's necessary. But an interesting one comes afterwards. The last one there is God's standard. Now, God's standard is what? Truth. Huh? But it is in the paragraph on life. And then we come to the paragraph on truth. There is no marginal heading. And you would have thought, well, that marginal heading really should be perhaps in the next paragraph, because it's the standard of truth there, truth. And this is something that happens quite often, that she gives a marginal heading that might cover one, two, or even three tones, subtones. She doesn't give just for every subtone a marginal heading. And if she takes some together, then she picks out the most important one. Here the most important one she wants to bring out, the standard of truth. But because we can see that she builds that standard of truth here, the tone of truth, on the preceding paragraph on life, and says, this is really your standard, that God is. That God is the abundance, that it is what it is. She begins to build up the standard of truth that he always does right on the fact that he is right, before she said that he does right. And therefore, marginal heading really covers both paragraphs. So it is very often misleading to just look at the marginal heading and draw conclusions from that. They must be very carefully weighed. And you will see later on too that one has to be careful about the marginal headings, because very often she would do this, that in a subtone she would put in the main tone, not the subtone. Very often she would put in only the subtone. So you can't quite rely, say, if you have say, the tone of life as principle, then in that passage she may not put in a marginal heading indicating principle. She may put in a marginal heading indicating life. Because she says, oh, I bring out the main tone here. I want to stress the main tone here. Sometimes she wants to stress the subtone there. And therefore, as a whole, don't be too much misled, I would say, by the marginal headings. Just be very careful in weighing what place value it really wants to bring out. All right, that's about marginal headings, because I have already drawn your attention to one or the other marginal heading. Usually there where it is easy, that's a trick, you know, of a teacher. He always first takes those examples that are easy so that the student feels, oh, it's easy. And then only afterwards he shows all the other tricks.